Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. When children love learning, they can tackle any challenge life throws at them. Sylvan's Insight Assessment can help you determine if your child is ready for what's ahead. It can also identify gaps in learning and point out areas that could be of concern for your child so they can tackle what's to come. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Friday edition of the Talking About podcast. I'm Sean Kennedy. With me this week, I'm happy to have Liberty Bowlers and many other outlets, Jackson Frank. Jackson, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you, Sean?
I'm great. Thanks for joining me this week. We were just talking offline, and I'm happy to have you because typically it's Dave and myself, and it's a very humorific Sixers slanted viewpoint. And while you do cover the Sixers for us here at Liberty Ballers, you're also, you have a wider scope of the league. You're doing work for other sites for other teams, and you watch, I'll ask you, how much Sixers would you say as a percentage is your overall viewing diet of the league?
I would say close to 25%. I watch almost every Sixers game. I can just, there's some games where, you know, it doesn't feel like, you know, like when a lot of the stars are missing or whatever, it doesn't feel like it would necessarily enhance my, you know, my understanding of the team. So I've, you know, missed a few games over the last couple of years, but I would say about 25%. They played 41 now. I'm a couple of games behind, but I've seen 37 or 38, I think. So yeah, I would say about 25% in the last couple of years, but maybe a little less, maybe a little more.
Okay. So you're catching nearly all the games for the Sixers, but also three times as many games for the rest of the league. So you have a good idea, better idea than me, anyway, what's going on elsewhere. So wanted to get a good zoom out perspective, and I thought you were a great person to have on this week because the Sixers are now at the midpoint of the season. They played 41 games. They're 25-16. So this is a perfect opportunity to kind of take stock of where the team is and kind of zoom out a little bit. So the first thing I want to ask you, Jackson, Sixers 25-16, they're currently in fifth place in the Eastern Conference. Based upon your preseason expectations for this team, would you say the Sixers have met them, they're below where you thought they'd be, or this is basically exactly where you would expect them to be?
I think it's about where I'd expect them. I think my general idea was that, like, I thought they could get to, like, you know, kind of flirt with second best team. I just think the Celtics are, you know, the class of the East, and obviously that, you know, that's kind of been affirmed at least through the halfway point. I thought like they could get to, you know, a level where the Bucks were at. I didn't know what to make of the Nets. I don't think anyone did. Obviously the Nets, you know, KD injury notwithstanding, or withstanding, whatever the proper phrase is there. You know, I've looked quite good as well. But I think the Sixers for the most part have looked solid. I think you, like, there's a couple of different ways you could say, okay, they're 25-16, but you've had, you know, your three best players each missed, you know, anywhere from about a third of the year to, you know, 20%, 25%. And they're still on pace for 51. So that's great. But then you go and look at this remaining schedule, and according to Tankathon, they have the hardest remaining strength of schedule in terms of opponent win percentage at, you know, 5.532. There's still three more games against the Celtics, two more against the Nuggets, another against the Grizzlies, three against the Nets, two against the Bucks, two against the Cavs. You know, we're done with the Thunder. And obviously the Thunder, we split that series against the Thunder. Or they split that series, whatever you want to say. So I think kind of about what I expected, right? If that makes sense, in the sense that, you know, they've had some injuries, but they've also had a pretty favorable schedule, and it's going to be a tough one. I know they have a pretty grueling, was it March or April to close the year, whereas, you know, the last few years they've often had a pretty favorable closing stretch. So that's not the case this year.
Yeah, it's, I remember years past, it felt like they closed the game out with two games against Detroit, seemingly every final week of the regular season.
Maybe the Hornets in there or something, somewhere in there late.
But yeah, not the case this year. I kind of agree with you. I feel like I had the Celtics and the Bucks in a tier above them coming into the season, and I thought, well, maybe the Bucks could slip a bit with the Middleton injury, but I think they've kind of performed to expectations. Brooklyn, as you said, I think an enigma was a proper term. Like, no one, that was a real mystery box what they were going to get, and they've kind of been a mystery box team. Like, they started off struggling, and then suddenly they couldn't lose, and now who knows with the KD injury what's going to transpire for them in the weeks to come. But yeah, just kind of all over the place with them, and they're sitting second in the East. I think Cleveland has probably taken the leap a bit quicker than many anticipated. I think the Donovan Mitchell acquisition, while that everyone recognized, that certainly accelerated their timeline. Like, what people were concerned, like, oh, what's the fit with him and Garland as far as like defensively, but with their front court, they've made up for those concerns, and Mitchell looks like a weight has been lifted off his shoulders a bit, and he certainly seems happy in his new locale, and him and Garland have been dominant offensively, so just everything clicking there. So yeah, I thought coming into the season, like 4 to 5, maybe 3 if things work right for the Sixers, that was kind of the range. And I think Cleveland jumping ahead, and maybe Miami being a bit below where we thought. That's, other than that, I think everything's kind of where we thought going into the season. So no big surprise there, in my opinion. It seems like you kind of agree. So
yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I think aside from Boston, like everyone, you know, I think it's kind of, you know, Miami, I think you can still have some hope that they'll figure it out. But I think it's kind of a five team tier right in the top of the East. I think, you know, like I said, Boston is there, but I think everyone else is kind of on similar footing, honestly. I think Brooklyn's been really impressive, but I do worry about kind of how versatile they can be in terms of defense. They're just a really small team that can't rebound very well. The Sixers are, you know, kind of this, and sometimes they're very small besides Joel. I think Cleveland's probably a wing defender, a wing shooter short. Milwaukee, I don't know. Like, they're 25th in offensive rating, which is just, I know that Middleton's missed a lot of time, but that's pretty dreadful. So I think everyone is really, really flawed outside of Boston. I think Boston has its own issues, but they're much less pervasive than everyone else. I think Philadelphia is right in that tier where, with the right deadline move and maybe some internal development and whatnot over the second half of the regular season, they can maybe, you know, just solidify themselves as, you know, a top 2 or 3 team, but everyone else is kind of, you know, jockeying for that second spot.
Yeah, it feels like one of those years where it just, how the playoff bracket breaks out and whether the particular path lends itself to advantageous matchups for a particular team will factor into it a lot, versus some years it's just like, well, these are clearly the two best teams and they're going to find their way no matter what. But I think there's a lot of A could beat B, but might lose to C, but C could beat B, you know, that whole thing, just based on matchups when the playoffs come out. But I agree, Boston's the most complete. They have the fewest holes, and they're kind of overall roster construction lends itself to like going up against any different matchups and still finding themselves in a competitive situation. So yeah, I agree with you that they're kind of a class above everyone else right now, which, I mean, kudos to them. I mean, they certainly had their share of question marks coming into the season with the coaching upheaval, and you know, it's hard to come off a finals loss and kind of you know, bounce back and maintain that level of focus. There could be a bit of a letdown, but they, you know, they've done their job so far, and they're, you know, 3 games up on the Nets and look to be right there as the class of the East right now. So well done by Boston, as much as it pains Sixers fans to have to admit it.
Yeah, I feel like Sixers fans had to say that a lot the last half decade. Well done by Boston, as much as it pains insert Sixers fans name here.
Yes, exactly. All right, so that's from a team perspective. And you mentioned the deadline. We're going to talk about that a little later and what might be areas they might want to focus on. But let's zoom into a player perspective. All-star voting is out right now as far as the fan voting. So Joel Embiid, after the first set of fan votes were in, he was in the top 3 for the front court vote. Right now he's fallen below Jason Tatum to number 4 as far as front court voting is concerned. Obviously the fan vote is only 50% of it, and media and player voting makes up 25% apiece. So it's not the whole picture. And of course, you know, if you're an all-star reserve, that's there's no shame in that. But wanted to ask you, Sixers fans very much in their feelings about Embiid being an all-star starter. From a more objective perspective, do you feel like he is worthy of being one of those top three spots in the East as far as front court's concerned?
I would right now have him over Giannis. I think like KD for me, you know, it'll become different, you know, as KD starts to miss more games. But KD for me is still like he's been my MVP pick so far. I think he's been the best player in the NBA, so he's obviously there. And then Tatum, you know, I think he's been right there as well. The thing that's really holding Embiid back compared to those two guys, you know, where I think on a per game basis, I think Embiid's been better than Tatum and just maybe a little less, maybe not quite as good as KD, but you know, they kind of split in hairs. But the big thing is KD's played 1400 minutes. Tatum's played almost 1500 minutes. Embiid's just, you know, crossed 1000. I know, like, I think that's just a tough thing to make up, like almost 400 minutes for, you know, less than fewer than KD and almost 500 minutes fewer than Tatum. That's a lot of games. That's, you know, roughly 14 games, 13 games, you know, and through 41, you know, total, that's a ton. Whereas with Giannis, I think Giannis has played about just under 1200. So I think on a per game basis, I think that's, you know, it's like, I think Embiid's been a little better. He's scoring the ball better. I know it's a better offensive environment. I think his defense, they've both been kind of up and down at times in terms of their kind of what's the kind of the proper rotations as a help side defender, things like that. So I just prefer Embiid a little bit there, but obviously, you know, Giannis has quite the you know, the leg up in fan voting. And then I just think, you know, media and players probably prefer Giannis just because he's, you know, this isn't necessarily fair, but it's probably how they're gonna look at it, right? He's a finals MVP, he's won two MVPs. Like, there's just kind of some of that cachet that I think Giannis has over Embiid that factors in, which isn't necessarily how things should go, but it is going to be how it unfolds. But I would have Embiid over Giannis right now for that third spot.
Okay, interesting. I might not have expected that. Yeah, I think it's kind of a moot point in that maybe the Durant injury lingers longer than Brooklyn would hope, and it kind of plays itself out. Maybe he's not even available for the All-Star game. Who knows? But I think these things always kind of work themselves out in the end. So to put a dramatic level of concern into something that's still a month or so away is not probably the best use of people's time, but it does make for an interesting conversation. It's hard to split hairs with these guys. They're all playing tremendously well this season. I think people have often made the availability concern for Joel in the past, but I think he's put the work in and gotten better in that department in recent years. This year, he has had a couple small things pop up. It started with the plantar fasciitis at the beginning of the year, where he was clearly coming off that and did not look like himself for the first week and a half or so of the season. He's had foot soreness recently, where he's missed a few games, and we're going to talk about that in our next segment. But it's just interesting to me that a guy who is leading the conference in scoring by a significant amount, like he's averaging 33.5, Giannis is 31. So that's a decent gap as far as top scorers in the conference, and is also one of the top defensive players in the league. And admittedly, as you mentioned, I don't think he's been at his best consistently throughout the year on that end of the court. I think it's pretty clearly, if you had to rank his seasons defensively, throughout his career, it's towards the bottom. But when he is focused and locked in, he's still a top defender in the league. And even Embiid on a bad day is still better than on, you know, 2/3 to 3/4 of the big men in the league on the defensive end. So it's picking nits to a certain extent. So with all that, it's interesting that, oh, he can't even crack the top three for front court. But I think it speaks to the talent level of the league. And I think the structure of all-star voting in a lot of ways, like, why do we need backcourt and front court? Or these are kind of like nebulous positions. Like,
especially with the way that Giannis and Embiid and KD and Tatum would all handle the ball, can all initiate possessions, all good passers.
Yeah.
Like, we'd like something against a guy like, you know, nothing against the way that a guy like Donovan Mitchell or a guy like Kyrie Irving's played this year, but like, Like, if those are going to be our backcourt guy, like, if those are going to be the East backcourt players, like, they don't think they, like, Donovan's been incredible, and I think Kyrie's also been quite good this year, but, like, they're not MVP candidates in the way that these four are. And so the fact that we're having to talk about, like, oh, I'm over here being like, yeah, the guy in Giannis is averaging 31 points, 12 rebounds, 5 assists, just under a block and a steal per game, and is scoring on above average efficiency in a pretty not good offensive environment. You know, I'm like, I don't think he should start the plays, start the All-Star game as an indictment on kind of how the format is structured more than anything against Giannis and the way he's played. I just think he's been the fourth best player in the East rather than, you know, a top three guy. But unfortunately, you know, as you know, they're still devoted to these outdated positions. And then you just like, I mean, ever like it's an All-Star game too. Like Joel and Giannis could both be the point guards of the East, and it wouldn't matter. They're both going to have a couple of court to court plays, right? Full court, coast to coast, excuse me, is the proper phrase. They're going to have a dunk or a pull up three, things like that in the All-Star game. So it shouldn't matter.
Yeah. It's very much more of an entertainment product than a competitive basketball game until the last 5 minutes of the game is concerned and people lock in. Although I have liked the new structure for the All-Star game in recent years, and I think that's helped. But yeah, still, to your point, like it's not like they're going to be running plays or anything. This is an All-Star game. It's like, just,
well, I would love this year if we get like an all big man lab out there. Can we get somehow on one team, can we get Jokic, Embiid, KD, Giannis, and like Luka or LeBron or something? Like, if you're not over 6'8", 6'7", I mean, maybe put Tatum in there. He's like 6'9", 6'10".
Yeah.
If you're not over like 6'9", you're not allowed to be in the closing lineup. They're gonna throw all those guys there. That'd be kind of fun. Like, at least make use of these the new age of kind of how offense is initiated in the new playoff or the new All-Star format. I think that'd be fun to see.
Yeah, absolutely. You can definitely have lineups of 6'9" and all and above guys that it still, you know, works because everyone's just so skilled at this point. Mm-hmm. Especially when you're talking about the best of the best, like this group. So wasn't something on our list, but since you kind of mentioned it, KD as your MVP favorite right now, I got to ask, where would Embiid stack in your hierarchy there as far as MVP is concerned?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think right now, like, it's roughly a six person race, right? You got in the East, we got the four guys we mentioned, then out West, you've got Jokic and Luka, right? I think those would be kind of the six that, you know, people would, you know, not dispute. I think right now I'd probably have Embiid fifth, you know, ahead of Giannis. Again, I just think, like, and again, he's just working from an uphill battle a little bit in terms of just like, you know, the games played where, you know, Luka's over 1400 minutes, you know, Jokic is over 1200, over 1250. And even if, like, I just think Jokic has been better on a per game basis. He's averaging 25 points, 11 rebounds, 6 assists, a steal a game, a block a game on 69% true shooting. Joe's efficiency is incredible, 64% true shooting. I know he's averaging about 8.5 more points, but then you go look at Jokic and he's at 69% true shooting, which is just ridiculous. I think it's over 11 points clear of league average true shooting. So I'd have Embiid fifth, but again, I think on a per game basis, he's probably been about like third, or I would say probably like third. I think, you know, like, I think he's been as good as Luka, Tatum, Giannis, but I think KD and Jokic have been a little better than that. And they also have, you know, the games played and minutes played argument, you know, over Embiid. So I would say fifth. And I think he's just been working from an uphill battle all season between the slow start and, you know, missing so much time to open the year. You know, he's kind of going to have to pitch a perfect game, right? Like, he's going to have to play, what, at least 70 games. And that would mean he's going to only miss one more, I think, if I'm correct. He's at 30 games played. They got 41 left.
Yeah,
and I don't think that makes sense for him in terms of gearing up for the playoffs and all that.
Yeah, from a team perspective, you don't want that.
Yeah, and I think right, you saw what Embiid played 16 or 17 straight games before he sat out three with the left foot soreness. So they're just gonna be cautious. And like, I know that, like, I think it'd be really, really cool for Joel to win one of these MVPs when he's playing like this, but it's just tough. You know, because he just needs a little more maintenance sometimes. And I think a guy like Jokic or Luka, who, you know, just proven to be a little more durable in their careers, which, you know, it's, you can take as a slight at Joel, but just the reality, I think any Sixers fan or Joel fan would prefer him to not have another one of these ridiculously weird injuries in the playoffs, right? So And I don't know if necessarily him playing all the time is related to that, but you know, it is a pattern, and I'm not blaming him, but it's just the reality that for some reason there's always something that comes up that, you know, kind of prevents Joel from being in his peak form in the playoffs, unfortunately, the last few years. So yeah, I'd have him fifth. And I think it's gonna be tough for him to move up a ton just because of, you know, like I said, the nature of how you know, how the Sixers are gonna handle him and how it makes sense for them to try to kind of maximize him and their title hopes.
That's fair, and I probably have him in a similar spot. It's at his peak, he's played as well as anyone in the league, but I think he's had more inconsistent stretches than he has even in past years. And also, the team is not, you know, one of the most dominant teams in the league. I think conservatively, you could say they're maybe the sixth best team in the league. Like, so should your MVP come from that kind of tier of team quality? Maybe if a guy's doing everything in his power to make sure that they're there when without him, they would be maybe not even a playoff team. I think that's kind of the situation you have to be in if you're not one of the top teams in the league. I think that's kind of where the Mavericks might fall more so, where if Luka wasn't doing what he's doing, like, are the Mavericks even a playoff team? Maybe, maybe
Or
not.
yeah, or Denver last year, even Joel last year pre-Harden trade. It is really weird last year how it seemed as though that one-off Nugget Sixers game on national television kind of swung the MVP narrative. And that's not to say that I don't think Jokic was undeserving, but it was just really weird logic how they did that. And that's the case with all of these awards and whatnot, is I don't like I the process often produces like fine results in my eyes, but I hate how the process works. Like, Joel was a better player after Harden arrived, and he somehow lost the MVP award despite being the front runner before he arrived. So yeah, it's just weird stuff like that. I don't understand it, but yeah, I get your point for sure that like maybe right, it'd be one thing if Joel had played every game and like they didn't have the talent, or he played close to every game, but you know, he's missed some time. He's part of the, like him missing some time is part of the reason they're not in that quite, you know, on a 55, 56 win pace. So we'll see. Long way to go still. Like I said, if he ends up playing, you know, 37 of the next 41 games, which I don't think makes sense for anyone involved, then he could certainly kind of get his name in there. Like I think, you know, we played last for 68 and he was nearly one. So I think kind of looking at maybe 65 is the threshold for him. And so that would require 35 games, I think is doable. But you know, if the other candidates are Luka and KD and Jokic, I guess maybe Luka and Jokic would be the only ones with the durability at this point. But like they played 78, 79 games. And they've been, you know, as good as Embiid on a per game basis, you're in a pretty tough spot. So we'll see. But yeah, I definitely agree with kind of how you're viewing things there for sure.
Yeah, my mind would be on Luka, but if I had to pick one to say he's going to win at year's end, that's where I'm going with it. I think his numbers, he's leading the league in scoring and he's top four, I think, in assists, and the narrative's there and the durability's there so far for him. So I think it's all
Yeah,
lining up for
I
him to
think
get
it's
it.
gonna be. I think it's going to be him or Tatum, unless Denver just kind of runs away with, you know, with the West, which is, you know, is impossible by any means. You know, they're 28 and 13 playing really well as of late, but you know, I think Jokic could be deserving again, but it does seem unlikely that he gets a third straight. There just is kind of that stigma around it, right? That like
Yeah,
three straight
there's voter
MVPs
fatigue.
is, yeah, it just it, well, it just three straight MVPs. Like people just think about that as a, you know, like the, you know, top 7 or 8 player of all time. And I do think Jokic is going to end his career really high up the ranks, but you know, people just kind of are going to wait until, you know, Denver makes a really, really deep playoff run or, you know, something like that. I know they made the Western Conference Finals once, but it's been a lot of early exits otherwise. So I'm not saying that's correct. I'm just saying that's how the reality of things. But yeah, Luka, they're playing on prime time a lot. You know, just had 35, 14, and 13 in a double overtime win over, you know, what is admittedly the banged up Lakers, but yeah, God, he played 53 minutes last night. I didn't even realize. Good Lord, get that guy in a cryo chamber or something until they play next. And they have a back to back starting on Saturday against the Blazers, so that's tough. But yeah, I think it's gonna be Luka Tatum for sure. Like I said, unless Denver is just, you know, running through the West unscathed.
Yeah. All right. Well, you mentioned Joel's potential games played projections. We're going to talk about something that might prevent him from reaching that. But first, we're going to take a break and hear from our sponsors, and then we'll be back.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. As a parent, you want your child to have every opportunity, but giving them the tools they need to tackle every challenge, That takes a team. Now more than ever, educational support tailored exactly to what your child needs can make all the difference. That's why parents have trusted Sylvan Learning for 45 years as the ultimate teammate in their child's educational journey, instilling in them a love for learning and a passion for reaching the next level. And Sylvan's Insight Assessment can identify gaps in learning and areas that could be of concern for your child. It's a 360-degree view into your child's learning that you can't find anywhere else, and helps ensure that your child didn't miss something in school that might put them at a disadvantage in the future. And right now, it hits the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
All right, and we're back. So Jackson, you said from a team perspective, we don't want, or the Sixers would not want the MB to be playing nearly every game down the stretch. You want those load management days in there so he's fresh for the playoffs. And at this point, it doesn't even seem like run-of-the-mill load management. He missed a few games with the left foot soreness. And even as recently as Thursday night's game against the Thunder, we saw midway through the game, Joel's limping up and down the court. He insists he's fine. It's just something he has to kind of like play through. But how much do you feel this should be a level of concern for Joel and the team right now?
Yeah, I just don't know. Like, it's just, it's like, I mean, this is not a slight at Joel. I mean, it's just like, it's just, there's always something going on, right? And I'm not saying that in a negative way. It's just like, the way he plays is kind of this ball handling 7'7" guy who weighs 275 pounds or whatever is going to put a lot of force on your lower body. And you couple that with the fact he missed 2 years with lower body injuries. Like, it just seems like it's something that's going to stay with him. So I think, on a day-to-day basis, I'm not overly concerned because Joel has shown a willingness to play through things and a want to play through things. But I think bigger picture, yeah, there should be a little bit of concern. I think the hope would be that, like, you're just able to steal days here and there. But, like, as we mentioned earlier, the Sixers have a really tough second half of the year, and they're, about to embark on a West Coast road trip against, some good teams. I know the Jazz have been struggling as of late, but they still got a really dynamic offense. The Blazers struggle as of late too, but, playing, all the way, as far away as you can from Philadelphia basically is always tough. You got the Lakers, who maybe AD's back. They've been playing better as of late. The Clippers are out. Do they play the Clippers on this trip? I think they do, right? Maybe I'm off. I would imagine they do.
But no, I can check that. Yeah,
I would imagine they're not doing two separate trips to LA. I would hope for everyone's sake on that team or not, but they play the Kings. So
they play the Lakers and the Clippers. Two nights apart. So they're staying in LA for a few days.
As an aside, it always feels like it always happens in January. It feels like the LA trip or something, or late December. I feel like the last few years, or at least during the Joel era.
Well, yeah, it used to be in December every year because Disney on Ice was at the Wells Fargo Center in December around Christmas time. So they always had, it was called the Disney on Ice road trip. and I guess that hasn't been the case as much in recent years, or they did actually have a road trip in late December this year. It wasn't the West Coast. So that was always the case in the past as to why they had it.
The Disney on Ice road trip doesn't roll off the tongue as smoothly as the rodeo road trip like the Spurs have.
So, yeah, exactly.
unfortunately, we'll have to work on that one. But I'm not overly concerned. So, like, I've watched Joel, enough years to know that, like, there's always maybe some little ailment going on with him, and he still is able to kind of play up to his standard, whether it's as a rookie, top 25 guy. The next few years, top 10, the last couple of years, top 5 or 6. So you can go higher if you want. But that's part of the issue, with the second half grueling schedule, is that, like, you don't have any more games against the Pistons to sit them out, or, even games against the Bulls at home. Or I know the Pacers game ended up being quite close. The Pacers have been solid this year, but, like, that's a team that you still maybe feel comfortable. Obviously, they feel comfortable with Joel missing it at home. So, I think it's, just at least this year, it's going to be a bit of an issue in the second half of the year. But like I said, Joel's proven to, play through these things. And it just seems like right now it's kind of a pain management thing rather than, any sort of case where you could exacerbate the injury. Like I said, I imagine if he could exacerbate it, he wouldn't be playing. So not overly concerned, but, just, because like I said, the precedent that Joel has set, you know, is he's going to be fine in terms of, you know, how well he can play through these injuries. But yeah, it isn't ideal that he's kind of been dealing with something all season, you know, it seems like with his lower body. And I guess maybe most of his career, it seems like he's been dealing with something with his lower body, but especially this year.
Yeah. My feeling is they have about a month till the All-Star break and maybe just try to get him a rest day periodically until then and give him the full week. I know he'll likely be playing in the All-Star game, but aside from that one day he'd have the full week of rest, and maybe that would be enough to kind of get over this particular ailment. Because as you said, yeah, it does always seem like it's something, and ultimately you want him healthy as possible heading into mid-April to hopefully early May. So I think they have two back-to-backs over the next month, which isn't terrible. So maybe just take a day on each of those, and maybe one other, how they've done in the past, where they can kind of create a 4 to 5 day mini break for him by taking one game off, if any gaps in the schedule allow that. So,
But like for instance, like they end that the road trip, you know, on not this Saturday, but the next Saturday against the Kings. Like, do you sit them out against the Kings, and they don't play again until January 25th, that Wednesday? It's like, can you give them a week there? They play their second to last game against the Rockets at home before the All-Star break, then the Cavs, which, you know, it will be a big game for the team. Like, can you just sit them out both those games and steal a week and a half of rest? Things like that, right? So just stealing games, and maybe you concede one here, but you're confident you can beat a lesser team because you have Harden and Maxey and Harris in the fold. So yeah, or like you've got, you know, you put the Spurs on the road and you put the Magic at home the day before, you play a back-to-back with the Magic, or I guess not, yeah, or two and 3 days. Like, can you steal some of those games, things like that? So yeah, I definitely agree that you just got to be kind of really meticulous with kind of when you rest him, and kind of trying, like I said, the word is steal, right? The steal rest days and try to steal wins without him. So yeah, definitely agree there that it's going to be a matter of really kind of identifying the soft spots and what generally is a pretty tough schedule to, you know, close out the second half of the season, or just have the second half of the season.
Exactly. All right. So as the second half of the season approaches, we got, in addition to the All-Star stuff next month, we have the trade deadline, which will be coming up. Sixers don't have a lot of flexibility in that regard. They're pretty cap strapped and don't have a lot of assets left in the cupboard. But I guess just abstractly, Jackson, where do you think they would most benefit from improving the roster? Like, what role do they need to bolster, or what's the one function a newcomer could most help this team with?
Yeah, I think like another wing would be useful for them for sure. Just like a defensively inclined wing that you can trust a little bit offensively. You know, I think Matisse on the whole has been pretty solid this year. And like, I think, you know, our own Dave Early wrote a really nice extensive piece about it last week that was super insightful. You know, he and I come from, I think, different perspectives on how we view Matisse. But the reality is, you know, Matisse hasn't been particularly useful in the playoffs for 2 or 3 years running now. So I don't think you want to I get the idea of playing him more in the regular season to accrue wins and things like that. But like, I don't think he's a guy you want to bank on. I think as well as Shake has played, I think another guard could help, just because I do have some worries about Shake as a playoff guy. He's thrived a lot this year on like early offense stuff and bullying mismatches. And I think that's a really useful thing in the regular season, but I do worry about kind of how viable are kind of those hit ahead passes and, you know, attacking from the slot in the wings, you know, with 20 seconds left on the shot clock before the defensive set. How viable is that in the playoffs, and how viable is him like hunting some of these inept, you know, bench defenders? And so I think maybe like just at least keeping an eye out for something if a guard becomes available there. And then obviously, you know, the backup center position. I think like this team is so small and devoid of rim protection outside of Joel. And I kind of like my general kind of thing I've come to believe these days is that like, if you want to be an elite playoff defense, you have to have two rim protectors or two guys who can credibly protect the rim. And the Sixers only have one right now. You look at some of the best defenses over the last, you know, few years. You know, the Bucks 2 years ago with Brook and Giannis, even the Warriors last year with Draymond and Kevon Looney, you know, supplemented by strong point of attack defense, which I don't think the Sixers, you know, rival, you know, the point of attack defense with guys like Jrue Holiday or even Andrew Wiggins. They're not as savvy in terms of, you know, the Warriors would often kind of show on ball screens with Steph and Jordan Poole. So that would be kind of my three big things, but I would worry less about the guard depth and more about kind of another wing that maybe kind of makes Matisse less integral. And Daniel has less. I know Daniel has his integral these days, but like one of those two being integral is not ideal,
right?
I think. And
yeah, they were hoping House would be that guy, and it just hasn't happened.
Yeah, and it's weird because I was someone who I thought he made sense. Like I thought he was a good signing, but he just hasn't looked as spry laterally as he did with Utah. I know the offense is always kind of going to be maddening. I'm sure you could, if you talk to Rockets fans, they would tell you all day about Daniel House's unwillingness to just take a spot up three, which I know Sixers fans are obviously privy to these days. He loves his side step three, his kind of chaotic attacks to the rim. But yeah, I think another wing, and then like if you can find a playable, you know, rangy four, I think that that rangy four archetype who can kind of provide some offensive juice and a little bit of rim protection is really vital these days. And that's not to say it's going to be just abundant on the trade market, but just a little more rim protection would be a worthwhile thing. I know the Sixers fans are going to say, oh, like, yeah, like Paul Reed's that guy. And I'm not, you know, an anti-Paul Reed guy, but the key here is offensively viable. And as much as I enjoy Paul Reed defensively, he is not a particularly offensive viable player these days or at this moment in his career. So those are kind of be the two spots I'd be looking for with, you know, to keep in mind, like how, and just assessing internally, how much do we trust Shake in the playoffs? Yeah. I know he was pretty good in the bubble, but, you know, he hasn't really been a playoff guy the last two runs. So that's kind of what I would be looking at it like. But I think, you know, wing depth makes sense, but I really would be stressing kind of, can we find another rim protector behind Joel? Because there's been a lot of blueprints in the last few years, the last 6 or 7 years, that you kind of need two of those guys. And I'm not saying like all defensive level, which is kind of what Joel can be at his peak, but just someone you can trust to kind of provide some rim protection because they don't have that outside of Joel. And if this is going to be, I think it also depends kind of, are they an offense first team or the defense first team? Because I don't think they are equipped to be a defense first team in the playoffs right now, but they're, you know, the numbers bear out, you know, they're 10th in offense and 4th in defense. I know that's been, you know, a little closer, you know, or a lot closer since Harden returned. And they've, you know, as a whole, they've been a little more lackadaisical, kind of dating back to that Clippers game on defense. But yeah, kind of a ramble, but yeah, I think I would be targeting that kind of that rangy four compressed and rim protection, but it's a really hard archetype. So more realistic is a wing that you can trust, you know, offensively, that, you know, isn't Matisse or Daniel House.
Yeah, I'm willing to trust Shake. I think for 8 to 10 minutes in the playoffs, I think he's shown enough this year to roll with that. I agree, the backup big that can protect the rim's their biggest hole, but I don't think that's going to be something they can really acquire given the market. I think the wing upgrade is probably their best bet, but
A guy that I think makes sense, but I doubt will be traded just because he's young and on, you know, a team friendly deal, and the Blazers obviously are trying to maximize Dame's prime, is Drew Eubanks. He's been a really solid backup center for the Blazers this year. They're closing with him at times over Yusuf Nurkic. Can defend at the level a little bit, move his feet pretty solidly. Not like, I'm not saying he's a premier switch big, but he has some, you know, versatility in terms of coverage, pretty rim protector as well. So if he at all becomes available, you know, for whatever reason, he's a guy that I would absolutely be targeting. I don't think this makes sense either, just like but I think Amir Coffey is an interesting guy. Has some passing chops, can space the floor a little bit as a shooter. I don't know what he's shooting this year, but is a pretty willing shooter when he was in the rotation last year with the Clippers. Again, I don't really know what they could offer the Clippers, because the Clippers are obviously trying to maximize their title window, if that exists this year. That must have been quite up and down, but
they're so deep. Dave and I were talking about this when Sixers played the Clippers. They just have guys that would be like really good rotation guys that don't even play because they're so deep. So
yeah,
like there is something where they could get one of those guys off the Clippers if they wanted.
Yeah, it's just, I would just be curious, like, what do the Sixers have to offer there? But yeah, Amir Coffey hasn't played a ton this year. He's not really in the rotation because they're deep, and he's not shooting the ball well from three this year. But you know, last year 38% on, you know, over, you know, three attempts a game, you know, north of 50% of shots came from three, can pass the ball a bit, run a secondary pick and roll. I think he's a guy that I really like. Good size, can defend, you know, some stuff on the ball as well. So like Amir Coffey, I think makes sense. Same with Drew Eubanks, but logistically doesn't really align with given where both those teams are. But those are like, when I think about where the Sixers lack, those are two guys I think could help. Obviously two bench guys aren't going to, you know, address every weakness of this team, but I think those are two, you know, targets that if they're available would make sense to pursue. But I'll have more extensive thoughts, you know, as we get closer to the deadline and, you know, more names pop up in terms of who's available, who maybe the Sixers are looking at, things like that. But yeah, just Amir Coffey and Drew Eubanks, I think, could help, you know, fortify some of, you know, the non-Embiid minutes, or, you know, the non-Melton, or, you know, I guess just non-Embiid minutes, because you need more wing defense. You know, with Amir Coffey, if you're not going to have Embiid in there, you're not going to have Drew Eubanks. So I don't think they'd get both of them. I just think it's too unlikely that either are available, let alone both.
Yeah. All right. Good names to keep in mind. people always talk about the Sixers need to make moves, but there aren't realistic names that really get thrown out there very often. It seems to be like, oh, well, they had interest in Eric Gordon, but salary wise, that's impossible. And like Jay Crowder, but what did the Sixers have to offer that every team in the league that would might also want Jay Crowder couldn't top? So those are more realistic, achievable trade targets, maybe. So good to know. All right, we're gonna finish out with you put up a SB Nation Reacts piece recently on Liberty Ballers, and it asked what player stepped up the most in the wake of all these star absences for the Sixers. So I think it's been around 45 games combined that Embiid, James Harden, and Tyrese Maxey have missed this year. And I believe the names in the poll were Shake Milton, who really had a brief star turn for the team himself when he was running the show, when all the guys were out. Tobias Harris, who has kind of toggled between sharpshooter, catch and shoot guy. And again, when the guys were out, he kind of shifted back to more ball dominant version of Tobias we've seen in the past. George Niang, who's been the kind of steady catch and shoot guy throughout his Sixers tenure and has continued to shoot the ball really well and has that quick trigger for them off the bench. And then De'Anthony Melton, who has been the top acquisition from this past offseason. He's toggled back between the bench and starting role and has performed really well both as a shooter and been their top perimeter defender this year. So what's your pick from that group for the guy who's stepped up the most in the absence of the stars?
Yeah, you know, like before you even set the outline, Sean, obviously, because I came up with the poll question and you know, put it together, I've been thinking about it, and they've all given different things, you know, which you summarized quite aptly. But I think I go with Melton. I just think he's been, you know, at times he's been overextended on both ends, but he's been asked to do so much. Sometimes he's had to be a secondary ball handler. Sometimes he's had to guard really, really good perimeter options. Sometimes, you know, he's had to be kind of the guy that somehow helps steady their rebounding because he's quite good. He's quite a good rebounder for his size, I think he's what, 6'10" wingspan or something like that, 6'8". I don't recall exactly, but you know, at times he just has to bomb away from three, like he was in that Lakers game. I know they were only missing Maxey, but yeah. So I think go with him. I think he's been the best player, I would say second best player. Obviously, Tobias has been quite good, but I think he's been stepped up the most in those situations. I think he's kind of the most scalable of the four. But yeah, they've all been really good. They've all been, you know, key reasons why the Sixers are on 51 pace, despite, you know, as we mentioned, you know, the three best players, you know, being in and out of the lineup at different points this year.
Yeah. Melton's been terrific. I think it's kind of like when we talk about Bellinger, it's just how you want to view the question. If it's the guy that was most unexpected, I think it would probably be Shake, because he was kind of maybe out of the rotation entirely coming into the season, and then he kind of secured that 10th man role. But then he suddenly was back to like bubble Shake, playing against the Clippers when Doc was coaching the Clippers version of Shake, triple double, scoring close to 25, 30 a night for that brief stretch. And aside from all that, which is not the version of Shake the Sixers are going to need when everyone's playing, but just to have another viable guard who you feel trustworthy about having him as a two-way capable player in the playoffs. And we kind of mentioned, you said you might want to upgrade the spot, but I think even if they don't, you feel comfortable enough now with Shake. And that definitely wasn't the case coming into the season. Tobias, it's kind of just been more like a consistent version of what we saw towards the end of last year, which is awesome and it's been amazing. But if you want to view it as he's been the most helpful in terms of like raw production, then yeah, I would get that. But it's kind of what something just continuing what we saw towards the end of last season. So it wasn't as unexpected. Melton, I could definitely see going Melton because that was a bit of a wild card. We didn't know quite what we were getting, and he's, I'd say, exceeded all expectations. Just his shot making and volume in that regard. I think he's been as you mentioned, much more of a ball handling threat than we accounted for in the preseason. To me, I was like, this guy can't be a lead ball handler. I just didn't see it. It was really shaky, but he's been a lot more effective in that regard than I would have anticipated throughout the season now. And then, of course, the defense has been tremendous. So, yeah, I don't know where they would be without Melton, but they definitely wouldn't be in the mid-pack of the East. So, yeah, definitely a worthy answer with Melton.
I will say, like, I think the Shake one, given the circumstances, as you mentioned, kind of out of the rotation, and kind of how well he played when he was a starter for 8 games, you know, the 8 games they were without both Harden and Maxey, like, I could definitely easily be swayed. You know, average 21-6, 55% from the field, 45% from three, 96% at the line. You know, like he was a, you know, in a different sense, but he, you know, efficiency wise, he was basically like Steph Curry in those games. No volume was still, but like, yeah, I think I could definitely easily be swayed given kind of where he was coming from and how big of a load he was carrying as a creator during those 8 games. And he obviously he's been good, you know, in the games. You know, Maxey also missed before Harden came, you know, when Harden returned. But yeah, I think Shake might end up being my pick, but I like, I don't know, you convinced me quite easily, but I think those the guards would definitely be my top choices.
Yeah, it was really a wild stretch for Shake. Like those the hospital Sixer weeks were like we entered a different reality briefly. Yeah. It was pretty crazy. But yeah, as of course they've all been great stepping up at various points, and that's why the Sixers are still where they are despite the game's missed total from their big guns. So, all right, Jackson, this has been terrific to get all of this perspective from you and to talk all this out. Thanks so much for joining this week. Of course, in addition to your work at Liberty Ballers, you're involved in a lot of other outlets providing great content. Why don't you fill everyone in where they could find you and your work?
Yeah, so obviously you can read my work at Liberty Ballers. I'd love to do more work there if I could, but life demands, and my job demands other situations as well. But I'm at Dime Up Rocks, the analyst, and doing stuff for SB Nation as a whole on the main site this year. So you can find me there. I just wrote a kind of a mini feature on Franz Wagner, who's having an incredible year in year two. So go check that out. I'd love if you could read that. But yeah, thanks for having me on the show. I'm sure we'll talk again soon. And yeah, you know, hopefully, you know, for Joe's sake and Sixers fans' sake, we're talking after he is making his sixth consecutive All-Star game start.
Yeah, that's what Sixers fans want to hear for sure. So we'll see how it shakes out. But yeah, once again, Jackson, thanks for joining. Everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.